Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg. Today we welcome back to Route 51, Wausau's own Anne Speckard, an adjunct associate professor of psychiatry and security studies at Georgetown University and one of the top experts on the psychology of terrorism in the world. Anne has interviewed more than 400 terrorists, their family members, and their close associates. Her previous books include Talking to Terrorists, Undercover Jihadi, Inside the Toronto 18, and Warrior Princess, A Navy SEAL's Journey to Coming Out Transgender. Dr. Anne Speckard's newest book is Bride of ISIS, One Young Woman's Path into Homegrown Terrorism. It was inspired by the true story of Shannon Conley, a Denver teenager who converted to radical Islam and tried to travel to Syria to marry an ISIS extremist that she met online. Bride of ISIS is a fictionalized narrative that is a composite of real terrorism cases. Today on Route 51, we'll ask Anne Speckard what would make a seemingly normal American teenager become someone willing to kill and die as a terrorist. How does ISIS seduce American women online? And how does ISIS use the violation of women and even sex slavery as tools in its mission to govern and hold territory? Anne Speckard was kind enough to interrupt a summer stay in Managua to join us here in our Wausau studio. And as always, we invite you to join the conversation by giving us a call at 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or if you'd like, you can put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page, and I will read it live on the air. Anne, thanks so much for being back with us.
I'm glad to be here. And, hello to Wausau.
And we should mention that you are also married to Daniel Speckard, the former ambassador to Greece, who's got a lot of background in international affairs, so the two of you are plugged into a lot of different things.
That's true.
Let's talk about the book, specifically your work. You've interviewed more than 400 terrorists, their family members, their acquaintances, and their collaborators. You've published an exhaustive book, which we talked to you about before, chronicling those interviews, Talking to Terrorists, and another book about one particular group of conspirators, the Toronto 18. Now we've got this fictionalized story about a young woman who gets involved with one particular terror group, ISIS. Why did you feel a need to write that story?
Well, Glenn, I heard about Shannon Connolly's story. It's a true story, but I did fictionalize it because I couldn't find every single detail. And for that reason, I decided to go the fiction route and then endnote it. So it's the only novel you'll ever read with endnotes. So whenever you come across an endnote, you know this is true. You can look it up and find out what exactly is true. But I was fascinated with Shannon because, imagine, at 17 years old, a Catholic girl, the youngest of four girls, her mom's a professor, her dad's an IT professional. And she's basically the girl next door. And she converts to Islam. We don't know why. That part I fictionalized. And within 2 years, she's joined ISIS. And what I found out, I just kept reading and reading about her and being fascinated. She right away took a niqab. That's where they cover the eyes completely.
Right.
So, you know, head to toe covering, including her face, which is very, very conservative. Most Muslims that believe that they need to cover their hair, but not their entire face. And I wondered, is she hiding? Did something happen to her body? Does she feel a need to hide her sexuality, perhaps? And then she started.
And again, those are questions you would ask because of your background in psychiatry and dealing with post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Exactly. And so that's the way I went in the book. But she also got on the internet and tried to figure out, okay, what is Islam? And she right away found Anwar al-Awlaki. And al-Awlaki is a guy that we droned in 2011. He was a Yemeni American.
We killed him with a drone. We didn't drown him. We droned him.
Droned him, yes. For people up north here, you might think I said drowned. Droned. and it was a very controversial hit because he was an American citizen. So he didn't have a trial ahead of time. He just was killed. And he was in Yemen, and he had basically turned against the U.S. He was involved in the underwear bomber plot over Detroit. He was involved in a lot of plots. But more importantly, he had popularized the idea that every Muslim has the duty, according to him, and according to ISIS and al-Qaeda, to fight jihad. So you must come to the battlefield if you're a Muslim. That's your duty, to come and fight jihad. And if for some reason you can't come to the battlefield, you bring the battlefield to yourself and you fight it at home. So you do a stay-in, act-in-place attack. And Shannon became convinced of this, so she started downloading materials. She downloaded a guerrilla warfare manual from al-Qaeda. And she studied up on it, and she decided the thing that I would probably be able to do is carry out a VIP attack inside the U.S. And these people usually look at who voted for the war in Iraq, who voted for airstrikes. And then not only that, she started going on matchmaker sites, and she ultimately met an ISIS fighter. And they Skyped together. The guy, as usual, proposed marriage to her and that she come over to Syria. And here's another clue that maybe something happened to Shannon, because she's Skyping with her ISIS lover and her dad walks into the room and she says, "Dad," his name was Yusuf, "Yusuf has something to ask you." And her dad joins the Skype conversation, and Yusuf, following Islamic tradition, proposes marriage to the father, you know, for the daughter's hand, which is the way they do things. And Shannon must have thought her father would be delighted and agree. Of course, he freaked out and said, "Absolutely not." And then when he found out that she had received a plane ticket, he called the FBI. And the FBI visited this girl 9 times.
Some of these are also themes that occur in your fictionalized account of the character that you created, who is not Shannon Connelly.
She's Sophie Lindsay, and everything that happened to Shannon that I know is in the book, except I changed the end. The end for Shannon Connelly is that she was going to go and join ISIS. She first took some training in the Explorers, which is a pre-army kind of thing, and she hoped to bring skills to ISIS, but she went to marry her ISIS fighter and join as a cadre. And her father called the FBI and stopped her. So they waited till she was boarding the plane. And when she was boarding the plane, she had CDs of Anwar al-Awlaki, so obviously following him, and total plans to join ISIS. So she was caught and put in prison for 4 years. The judge threw the book at her and said, I want to discourage others. And there are others, Glenn. She's not the only story.
Right.
This is not atypical.
And did you have a chance to interview her?
No. I asked the lawyer if I could interview them both. I wanted to interview both the both parents and Shannon, but the lawyer said, no, they don't want anything to do with media.
So without any background information, you thought it was better to go with this fictionalized account. And you're very specific that the character you invented, Sophia, is not Shannon Connelly.
That's right.
And we need to be very specific about that on the air here, too.
Right, right. It's Sophia Lindsay. And the book follows Shannon's life, except that we don't know why she converted. I made that up. And in this case, I made her a sexual assault victim and someone that did want to hide her body and was trying various ways, which are very typical to a sexual assault victims, of trying to cope with it without telling anybody, because teenagers keep these dark secrets oftentimes. So using alcohol, using bulimia, and then ultimately finding radical Islam and thinking this is the way to purify myself and redeem myself.
Who was Sophia at the very start of the book? When you open page one, what kind of a young lady is she?
Well, I'd say she's the girl next door. I mean, she's the girl that grew up in a Christian, in this case, in Shannon's case, Catholic family. And you know,
you grew up as a Catholic too,
yes,
correct?
I did. Yes, I did. And, you know, having a good time. She's sneaking off to a bar to party with her friends, and her dad is more strict than most dads. And she's, you know, rebelling, doing the kind of normal teenage thing. And it doesn't work out well for her because she gets date raped. So if you're a very sensitive person, skip the first chapter and just know that that happens.
Well, the first chapter is what's kind of important in setting up her descent into terrorism.
Although you wouldn't have to read it if it really bothered you. You could just know that that happened.
And there was a brutal rape case. She was, what, 16 years old when this happened in your book? And she got left by her friends at a party. She was drinking and wasn't supposed to be at a party drinking. Her dad, as you said, was very strict. Guy offers her a ride home. Seems like a nice guy. And it did not end well.
Right. And this is a story that happens all the time. I mean, 1 in 10 women in America have rape in their background. So, you know, there's plenty of women that you know that will never tell you, but they've been assaulted, particularly in date rape situations. And so I pick this as a typical scenario for a vulnerability to later fall into extremism, because people don't go into extremism unless it somehow resonates with something hurting inside, with a need inside. You know, sometimes it's loneliness. And I should say that I did end up talking to Shannon's mother, because right before the book was to be published, someone gave me her professional email. And I really debated whether I should contact her, because the lawyer had said they don't want contact.
Right.
And I thought, you know, I'm not media. I'm not, you know, hounding her for a media interview. And this book is going to come out. It would be nice not to blindside them. So I contacted, and the mother's very nice. And I told her how the book was written and the things I fictionalized, including the rape. And she wrote back to me and said that she thought her daughter's case more closely matched a New York Times expose case, where it's a very lonely girl living in a rural area. And this particular girl in the New York Times case, she was a minor at the time that she got radicalized. She put out on Twitter, why would people behead? Why would ISIS behead?
Yeah.
And guess who answers her? ISIS. And she suddenly gets surrounded by all kinds of Twitter friends and Facebook friends, and they answer all her questions. And she's a Sunday school teacher, so also the girl next door. And they say, that's so good that you're a Christian. Did you know that Islam is the completion of Christianity?
You know, the internet was supposed to make the world a better place, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It doesn't
yeah.
always work out that way.
No, you can get in contact with some pretty bad characters on the internet.
We're talking to Ann Speckhard. She's written a new book called Bride of ISIS. She's a Wausau native. She's a professor at Georgetown University. She has interviewed more than 400 terrorists, many of them face-to-face, many of them in dangerous situations. And she has used those interviews to create a composite story of a young lady who gets seduced by terrorists and becomes a suicide bomber. If you'd like to talk to Anne, 1-800-780-9742. That's 1-800-780-9742. Or put a comment on the Route 51 Facebook page. I will read it live on the air. So, Anne, your character, Sophia, descends into alcoholism and bulimia at the tender age of 16. She flunks out of high school. And when she hits rock bottom, then she becomes a Muslim. How does that happen?
Well, that's actually I picked that out of other cases, that when someone feels horrible guilt, especially of a sexual nature, that religion can be a purifying force. And, you know, she could have just as well found Christianity and felt like I you know, get rebaptized or redeemed and purify myself. But in this case, and in real cases that I know of, people have believed that by turning over a new leaf and dedicating themselves to Islam, that they will be purified, and then they go a bit on the rigid side of things and fall into extremism. And Islam teaches that you don't know whether you're going to go to heaven or not. You have to earn it, and everything will be weighed. So if you've done something that you feel guilty about, your scale is tipped quite a bit. So the way
you got to make up for it.
The way you can make up for it is you can volunteer for a martyrdom mission, because martyrdom is the one way you can guarantee yourself into paradise.
And of course, not all Muslims believe this. This is a particularly twisted, perverted form of the religion.
I think that most Muslims, probably all Muslims, will tell you that a martyr will go to paradise, but they don't believe that a suicide bomber is a martyr. So, you know, in the Quran, martyrs can be people that fall off of tall buildings, or martyrs are people that are killed in behalf of standing up for Allah. But
you grew up as a Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
You studied the martyrs, the Christian martyrs, I assume, when you were young?
I put this in my introduction to Talking to Terrorists. I went to Catholic school up till sixth grade, and I was a voracious reader. So imagine I went into the library that was meant to be for up to eighth grade and read every single biography that they had of martyrs. And I think there was something like 800 of them, probably when I was in first and second grade. I don't even remember those books anymore, except that they all ended with somebody saying, I refuse to give up my faith.
And did that inspire you?
I think it made me understand and be captivated and fascinated with anyone of faith who would say, I will give my life for my faith, even if it's a twisted and sick way of doing it and taking others out in doing so.
You know, we have a substantial, not a huge Muslim population in north central Wisconsin, but I would say a substantial one. And we have gotten criticism before that the word terrorist seems to only be applied by the media and especially by politicians to Muslims. We don't apply it equally to self-described Christians who might be members of white supremacist groups who commit violence. And I'm thinking specifically of Timothy McVeigh, who blew up the Murrah Federal Building because he was upset by the way the government treated a self-described Christian, David Koresh, a few years earlier on that very day. Also, we have the Posse Comitatus. That's a white supremacist group that was active in Tigerton for a while and tied to Christian identity groups. The Ku Klux Klan considers themselves to be a Christian organization. And I'm also thinking of that young man who shot and killed all of those people at that historic church in Charleston. So, you know, religious extremism is not something that just applies to Islam.
That's absolutely true. And there's a report that shows that if we're looking at threats inside the homeland, it's probably 50-50. So Islamic-related terrorism and far-right groups, it's 50-50. And we should also add to that that every religion that has any scriptures that say use violence for certain situations has been used to justify terrorism. So we have a Jewish guy in Hebron, Barak Goldstein, who goes into a mosque and mows down people that are in the act of prayer. I mean, just savagely kills them and believes that he's following and enacting the Book of Esther. And we've had abortion clinic terrorists that have stood outside of abortion clinics and waited for the doctor to come out and shot him in cold blood.
And we've had people who've used twisted interpretations of Hinduism and even Buddhism, which is a, you know, a pacifist religion for the most part. There are examples of Buddhists who've committed violent acts in the name of their religion. So,
right. So, you know, it's not just Muslims. It just happens to be that that's the flavor of the month right now. So, you know, it's that part of the world, which probably has a lot less to do with religion and a lot more to do with poor governance. So, you know, we saw years ago that people in the so-called Muslim world were trying to stand up to dictators using Marxism. Didn't work. So then they turned to Islamic movements. And, you know, we don't know what's next, but hopefully they'll get rid of their dictators.
Yeah, you've got poverty. You've got lousy schools. You've got a history, you know, thousand-year history of sectarian strife. All of those things come into play.
Yeah, and we know that with ISIS. I mean, al-Qaeda wore out its welcome in Iraq, al-Qaeda 1.0. The Anbar provinces got sick of them and wanted to kick them out. The people will make use of terrorism when they see it as useful to them. And when we invaded Iraq and al-Qaeda came into Anbar and said, we can restore Sunnis to power, we can get out the invader in our country, join up with us and endorse terrorism with us. I mean, they didn't call it terrorism. People agreed. It all went away, and it reappeared when the Shia government wasn't being fair to the Sunnis. And again, the a message from ISIS terrorists were, we can restore the Sunnis to dominance. We can get your power and your resources back, but you're going to have to endorse us with our terrorist methods. And people did.
And I don't want to get into the geopolitical stuff and talk about who's responsible for the rise of ISIS in Iraq and so on. But, you know, maybe we should have left some Sunnis in positions of power after we deposed Saddam Hussein. And maybe if that had happened,
I think everyone,
it would have been a little bit better.
I think everyone agrees that de-Ba'athification in retrospect was a mistake.
We're talking to Anne Speckard. She is a person who has made a career out of studying the psychology of terrorists. She's talked to 400 of them and their family members and close associates. Bride of ISIS is the new book. I'm Glenn Moberg. This is Route 51, 1-800-780-9742. If you'd like to join the conversation, that's 1-800-780-9742. We'll be back after this short break.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Peninsula Players, Ganchert Nursery, and Marshfield Clinic. Proud supporters of WPR programs. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Christine Bremer Moogley of the personal injury law firm Bremer & Trollope, committed to protecting the rights of accident victims throughout Wisconsin. Bremer & Trollope, because the right results matter most. Bremer-law.com.
I'm Glenn Moberg. You're back on Route 51 with Ann Speckard, whose new book is Bride of ISIS. She is a Wausau native who has interviewed more than 400 terrorists and has produced a fictionalized account, and it is a gripping one. I couldn't put the book down. About a young lady, a normal American teenager, who becomes seduced by ISIS on the internet and becomes a suicide bomber. Matt on Facebook asks, what role has our foreign policy decisions led to the rise in terrorism directed toward us? I, for one, would be pretty angry if bombs from another nation were raining down in central Wisconsin. I did not want to get into the geopolitical stuff, but Matt does. So what are your thoughts on that, Ann?
Well, hi, Matt, and thank you for your question. I can tell you that all over the world, I was asked by terrorists that I was interviewing, well, why are you interested in us? Why aren't you interested in your own country? Your own country is terrorist. And my answer to that was, I can understand, you know, what you see as grievances, but hopefully my country doesn't intentionally target civilians for the purpose of causing terror to try to move the political process, which is how I define terrorism, although there's 400 definitions of it. And nobody would like drones flying overhead and disrupting their daily life. And most terrorists live with their family members. So when we do drone them, their family members, innocent civilians, get killed with them, and that's problematic.
And they take those pictures, put them on the internet, and they're able to convert more people to their cause.
Absolutely. I mean, I can tell you about a Palestinian suicide bomber that I talked to, and when a little child was killed by the Israelis, that's what motivated her to move into the role of volunteering to be a suicide bomber.
How is ISIS worse than other terrorist organizations? How is it different from other terrorist organizations, and how is it similar?
They're different in really interesting ways. Well, they've formally declared a caliphate. So that
explain that.
There was a caliphate in the
explain
past.
Explain what a caliphate is.
Oh, okay. Well, it's like a union, you know, of grand state in the name of Islam and run according to Islamic teachings and Islamic governance.
It's got to be run by a messianic leader. Is that true?
Yeah, he's put in place by Allah because, you know, these are old time things, just like royalty used to be, you know, God ordained. So the caliph is the head of the Islamic people. And there was a caliphate that went from Uzbekistan to Spain. It was huge. And Muslims are very proud of that. And there was a lot of learning. I mean, the Enlightenment came from a lot of the learning from the caliphate. And they hearken back to that. So when the caliphate is redeclared, it's kind of exciting. And, you know, there's a part of normal people that's like, whoa, is that really going to happen? And it also goes to end times teachings. Many Christians believe certain things are going to happen in the end times. Well, Muslims have their beliefs, too.
They're both Abrahamic religions, you know,
right.
that and Judaism are the three that are descended from the same base.
Right. So a lot of prophecies that are signs of the end times are happening now. And one of them is that Sham and Iraq will be retaken, that the caliphate will reoccur there, and that a road will that the Mahdi, who is the person that's going to come and reestablish everything, will walk on that road between Iraq and Syria. And anyway, so people hearken to this. And
so they are setting things up and doing the things that have been prophesied.
Right, right. So they're creating excitement, and then they're extremely good on social media. I just put out a paper. Well, actually, it's not put out yet. I just submitted it. And it's all the posters from ISIS. And if you look at these posters, they're just so good at manipulating emotions and with messages. Like, for instance, there's one, a gun with blood on it. And it's Y-O-D-I-O. And it says, you only die once. And you know the saying, you only live once.
Right.
Well, you only die once. Why not make it matter, die a martyr? And, you know, so they hearken to things where what we talked about earlier.
That Westernized images on these posters?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And they have one about sometimes people that have made the worst mistakes in their lives turn out to be really good people in the end. And they show this glowing figure of an ISIS fighter with a sun shining behind him and a big assault rifle, as though, you know, you can have a do-over. You can start over and you can make your – you can purify yourself by coming to ISIS.
All right. Those are the images. But this group, ISIS, is so brutal in its methods.
Yes.
Crucifying people, putting a serviceman in a cage and burning him alive.
They're horribly ruthless, and probably what they're reflecting is the horrible ruthlessness that has happened in Iraq since basically it got destabilized by our invasion. And if you were there, Glenn, as I was, and know people, like I have a friend that
you worked. You were in Iraq.
Yeah. I came and went to work on the detainee rehabilitation program. And one of my good friends worked for the U.S. Embassy certifying how people were killed. And so she went to the morgue. And the way people were killed in sectarian killings is just unbelievable. I mean, acid killings, you know, they'd stab you or shoot you, but then they'd have to drill a screw through your head, you know, just to be nasty or behead you or dismember you. And this has been going on now for years, back and forth between the Shia and the Sunni. So what ISIS is doing is not completely new.
But the group is also doing something that is reprehensible to every human being on the planet Earth. They've destroyed unique, priceless, historic and cultural artifacts of the ancient world, irreplaceable, some 3,000 years old. Things that are important to everyone. And you'd think they'd be particularly important to people who grew up in the area because that's their heritage.
You're wrong on that. Not to everyone. There's a group of people, just like we had back in the Middle Ages. I don't know my history exactly, the Renaissance. Whenever those people came and smashed church windows and smashed church statues, there's a group of Muslims who are very conservative who believe that any representations of figures and people is against Allah and haram and must be destroyed. And that's who they're representing.
And I guess it was, in about 300 or 400 AD that a group of Christians burned the library at Alexandria down in Egypt.
And we had al-Qaeda bomb those Buddhas. Remember those amazing statues
right.
in Afghanistan?
Right.
Horrible.
And now the latest atrocity. We've got an 82-year-old archaeologist, Khalid Assad, who spent 50 years helping to preserve and understand the cultural treasures of the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra. They behead this elderly, kind man, and they hang his body on a column in the main square. Why would anybody do something like that?
Because they saw him as a horrible sinner. He's against what they believe, which is no representations of figures are allowed. And he was the preserver and guardian of what they view as haram and sinful. And it's horrible. I'm not endorsing it in any way, but you can explain them within their belief system. They hark back to what they believe and interpret, I believe wrongly, of how Muhammad and his companions would and did act. And they're horribly ruthless to anybody who disagrees with their worldview and their beliefs.
Let's get back to the story of your fictionalized character, Sophia, who in your book, The Bride of ISIS, is seduced into this world.
Mm-hmm.
She starts wearing a burqa. And that burqa makes her feel empowered.
This is true.
And that is such an alien thought to most normal American teenagers, that covering yourself from head to foot would make you feel empowered. But that's how your character, Sophia, reacted.
Oh, well, I can talk to all the women listeners, if there are any. You know, every day you worry about how you look, and you worry about your clothes and your figure and your hair. And I can say I used to go to the mosque in Brussels when we lived in Brussels and take Arabic lessons, and I wore a headscarf. And it was fascinating to wear a headscarf and feel what that's like. You lose your peripheral vision, but you don't have to worry at all what you look like. And there's a freedom in that. And nobody looks at you. Men don't look at you. But people look at you, oh, you're a Muslim. Like, what kind of weirdo are you? And people were mean to me when I was driving, extra mean. They're mean drivers anyway in Belgium. But So you get this aggression towards you. And, you know, if it truly is your religion, I was just covering because I was taking Arabic lessons at a mosque. Sophia, as the fictional character, is kind of enjoying that. Like, you know, I can scare people, and suddenly feeling her power. And remember that this is she's a fictional character, but a woman whose power has been taken away from her.
Through that brutal rape at the beginning of the book.
So now she can scare people, and she overhears people making comments of, you know, what's she hiding under there? You can't tell, you know, she might have a bomb. You know, she may be a threat to me. And she enjoys being this black raven that scares other people, and they can't know anything about her by looking at her because it's only her eyes showing.
And she spends a lot of time in chat rooms in your book, and she becomes enamored with the figure that we've already talked about before, videotaped messages from Anwar al-Awlaki, a real-life al-Qaeda ideologue who, as you said, was killed in a drone attack. And even after he was killed, he's still recruiting people.
Awlaki, I say he inspires from beyond the grave, and he's still alive on the internet. I mean, we droned him, but he's still alive, and he's still delivering. There is hardly an attack in the West that Awlaki was not involved in. Chattanooga shooter, I had downloaded Awlaki. Toronto 18 had downloaded Awlaki. There's a woman in King's College, top in her class. She started downloading Awlaki, dropped out of King's College. This is in London. It would be equivalent of Georgetown or Harvard. Top in her class, kept listening to all his sermons and decided that he convinced her she has to do jihad. And if she doesn't go to the battlefield, she has to bring it home to herself. So she went and researched who voted for the invasion in Iraq. This is back for the first invasion, or the second invasion, but when we troops, you know. Mm-hmm. And she figures out who it is. She goes to her parliamentarian, pretending that she's on a visit. She's really got a knife, and stabs him repeatedly and was aiming to kill him. And the police interviewed her, and she said, I watched all these Awlaki videos, and I became convinced. They looked at her computer.
And your character, Sophia, same thing. She figures out who voted for the invasion, and she goes out to kill a U.S. senator.
Right, right.
And in your book, Sophia meets a Tunisian extremist, Hamid. They have conversations on Skype, and he seduces her, asks her to be his bride. What kind of language do these people use in order to get through to these Americans?
Well, most of them that are Skyping or tweeting or Facebooking with Americans are speaking English to them, and they're very savvy. And they start slow. You know, they just encourage you in your walk or encourage you to convert. And like I told you, this New York Times true case, she just tweeted out what kind of people would behead. And they answered her, and they told her all about Islam. They got her to convert. And they told her, don't go to the local mosque, because they knew the mosque, you know, most Muslims don't agree with what they are preaching. So they said that they will tell you all wrong. Can we send you books about Islam?
And this Hamid character says very sweet, poetic, and mm-hmm. respectful, above all respectful things toward her.
Well, I can tell you another story. There's a journalist in France who pretended to be an enamored teenager, and she put up a video of a jihadi in ISIS the same day he contacted her. And he said, oh, you watched my video. Did you like it? And then he asked her to Skype with him, and she decided, okay, I'll go along with this, because she wanted to learn more. And same thing, you're so pure. If you come to Raqqa, I'll give you a big dowry. Anything you want, you'll be the princess of Raqqa. You're so pure, you're so good, you're so beautiful. I want you as my bride. And calling her and texting her constantly.
And as in the case that inspired your story, Hamid asks your fictional character Sophia's father, Jake, the strict disciplinarian, for her hand in marriage.
That's right, which it totally mirrors the real case of Shannon Connolly. And of course, Jake freaks out and is like, no, over my dead body.
Steals her passport.
He takes her passport. In Shannon Connolly's case, he just kept an eye on her. And when he saw that she had I call it a one-way ticket to hell. She had a one-way ticket to Frankfurt. He called the FBI and said, you need to do something.
Now, in your story, the parents of the fictional character Sophia get visited by two FBI agents, Ken Follett and Kathy Chambers, who are tipped off to her radical behavior. How did the parents in the fictional story react?
they don't believe it. And they see it as a stage and, you know, oh, our teenager, she'd never do anything. And, you know, she's just going through a phase. And, you know, think about it. Anybody who's raised teenagers, they do try on lots of different identities. And a lot of times there are identities that are rather oppositional to our own identities because they're trying to find themselves in contrast to us.
And you get the feeling that her parents, although well-meaning, made some mistakes and could have done some things to maybe have better communication with their daughter and keep all this from happening. Jake, the strict disciplinarian, won't let her go out on dates. And Sarah, the mother, is a lawyer, an aspiring lawyer, and she is just overwhelmed with her casework and doesn't have time for her own daughter.
You know, actually, I tried to write that from my own experience of raising teenagers, because as a parent, you try to be on top of them and you try to know what's going on. But, you know, you open the door when they come home from school and you ask them, how was it? And would you like any food and this and that? And they don't want to talk to you. And, you know, at that stage, usually you have something going on in your life that, you know, either volunteer work or career that you're interested in. And you may not notice that they're really getting into something that's dangerous or harmful to them. And then if somebody comes and tells you, you're like, what? And I just thought that that was every parent. I mean, of course, they could have done better, and I did make them a bit out to lunch. But, you know,
but at the same time, it's a message to parents. Communicate with your kids. Know what they're up to. Keep a two-way conversation going.
Particularly if you see them convert and interacting on the internet, because even in moms these days, there's programs where they're going out and teaching imams what ISIS is putting on the internet, and the imams themselves are totally shocked. They're just amazed by what teenagers will run into. And you know, what we're blind to, our teenagers will find.
Sophia ends up volunteering to be a suicide bomber. What are the final things that put her over the edge in your book?
Well, she was going to marry her lover, and this is where I departed from Shannon's case, because she was arrested trying to go to her lover, and I decided to make the end a bit more exciting. So I had it that she was going to go, but her father took her passport, so she had to wait for another passport. And in the meantime, if she couldn't get a passport, she was going to consider doing an attack at home. But her lover, you know, sweet-talked her, and she was very excited to marry him, and then he gets killed. And this mirrors other cases that I have interviewed where—
So she's grieving.
She's angry.
And that puts her over the edge.
Traumatic grief. I mean, traumatic grief, think about it. You know, the stages of grief are anger and bargaining and, you know, it can't be. And she's going through all of that. She's angry. So she immediately volunteers and says, I can't come over to Iraq. I don't have my passport. Give me a mission to do here. I was thinking about doing an attack here anyway. Give me a mission. So she's a woman on fire, angry, and believing a false ideology that as soon as she's dead, she'll be reunited with her lover, because they'll both be dead and they'll be martyrs and they'll be in paradise.
And she decides to blow up this gathering at a speech before a U.S. senator. The book picks up speed there. Ken and Kathy, the FBI people, and Sophia's father try to prevent the act. The police arrive. There's a cliffhanger ending, which I will not reveal. Where do you learn how to write fiction, Ann Speckhard?
Well, I've always been told that my nonfiction writing is easy to read and that it reads like a journalist, so that's nice. And I did have a professor that was an immigrant, and she always said people that use big words and write in a way that nobody can understand basically should be shot. And, you know, if people don't understand your writing, why bother? And I did hire a very good editor. Her name's Maya Sloan, and she helped me a lot. She went through the book page by page and said, you know, here you need to develop this character more. Here you need to build the suspense more. And then I did what she said, and I guess I achieved it. I'm happy to hear that.
We're talking to Ann Speckhard. She's a Wausau native. She has written several books, and the latest is Bride of ISIS, a fictionalized account based on 400 interviews with terrorists, their family members, and their close associates, a composite case that is nonetheless true to life, even though it is a work of fiction. 1-800-780-9742 if you'd like to join the conversation or put a comment on Facebook. I'm Glenn Moberg. We'll be back after this.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Chippewa Valley Cultural Association, Lee Yawkey Woodson Art Museum, and the Wisconsin Youth Symphony Orchestras. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. Go to WPR.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Wausau's Woodson Art Museum, featuring after dark photographs of North American botanical gardens, illuminated only by moonlight and flashlight, on view through August 30th. LYWAM.org.
I'm Glenn Moberg. You're listening to Route 51 Regional Talk Radio on Wisconsin Public Radio's Ideas Network. Our guest today is Ann Speckard, whose new book, Bride of ISIS, is a fictionalized account that includes her experiences interviewing 400 terrorists, their family members, and their close associates. In this fictionalized account, Ann, you have these two FBI agents, Ken and Kathy, and Ken in particular is racked with self-doubt about whether or not, when they infiltrate some of these meetings and groups, whether they're really entrapping people, whether they're dealing with a young kid who might be shooting his mouth off and suddenly they're encouraging him to get guns and bombs and maybe leading him to do something that he wouldn't otherwise do. This is a real problem, isn't it, with investigative work?
It is. We have to wrestle with this whole issue of entrapment, because what I found with my 400 interviews is that there is a lethal cocktail of terrorism. There's a group, an ideology, social support, and then the person with their individual vulnerabilities that resonates to the first three. So imagine you're a young guy spouting off your mouth on Facebook and Twitter and everything else, you know, endorsing ISIS. And two guys come that are older than you. They work for the FBI, but you don't know that. And they say, hey, brother, we've seen what you're writing. And, you know, we can take you the next step. Would you like some guns? You know, what kind of attack are you thinking of doing? Well, they've provided you with social support, haven't they? And, you know, you may go to a whole nother level. So now put yourself in the position of the parent of that kid. How do you feel? You know, that kid, if he goes along with everything, and there are actual cases like this. We have a case from Alexandria, which I based the one in the book on, where a young guy was spouting off. It was about Al-Qaeda. Two guys came to him, and he said he wanted to do a suicide mission, and he would like to attack the Capitol. So they gave him a fake vest and a fake rifle and drove him to the steps of the Capitol. And he, of course, got arrested with his fake equipment as a would-be suicide bomber.
How did his parents react?
Well, he was actually an immigrant, so I don't know, honestly. But Wired magazine has followed a lot of these cases and said, you know, these are troubling. And I don't know the exact answer to it. And that's why I put it as something to be wrestled with in the book.
Well, your character, Ken, the FBI agent, wrestles with it. But he seems to come down pretty strongly at the end of the book on the need to aggressively pursue these people.
In a moment of strong emotion, yes. And but at other times he's concerned, are we pushing people that are vulnerable to go further? And you know, we had this Boston policeman whose son was mentally ill, and he let the FBI know, my son is mentally ill and raving about ISIS. And so the FBI went to visit him pretending to be part of ISIS and offered to sell him some guns. And, you know, the guy got arrested and he'll face a trial. And maybe because of his mental health issues, he'll, you know, receive some leniency. But it's troubling. And it makes you think, okay, a police officer is probably going to contact the FBI. But think if Shannon Connolly's father hadn't called the FBI. And, you know, the bravery that took to call about your own child, which brings up a whole other issue other than entrapment, shouldn't we have hotlines where a psychologist and a moms can help you, that you can call and say, you know, I'm really worried about my kid. They're going off the deep end on this ISIS stuff. Could somebody come and talk to him, try to talk him out of it?
As Christians often have priests intervene, mm-hmm. you could have an imam mm-hmm. who represents mainstream Islam intervene.
Right, and a psychologist to come and say, you know, really, what's your problem? Because in Shannon Connolly's case, the FBI did talk to her 9 times. But, you know, they don't have that training. You know, FBI, they're law enforcement. They're really good at what they do.
1-800-780-9742. Let's go to the phones. Martha in Eagle River, you're on Route 51 with Ann Speckard.
Yes, hi. And I spend a lot of time over in the Middle East doing international aid work, particularly over in Afghanistan and Jordan and other, you know, other parts of the country. And I just want to make a couple comments, and it follows up with what you're just saying about pushing vulnerable people. A couple things that I notice all the time when I come back into the United States is, as you are aware of, is the media just latches on to one thing and into extremism, no matter what it is, and being spoon-fed. So most Americans really don't take the time to understand Islam or even go to the extent of, you know, meeting a Muslim person and their family, because, as you know, most of them are very family-oriented, and they are not extremists. And what happens is that we are sort of part of the problem, I think, because we create this isolation, particularly with the media, with the young people here in this country who are Muslims, who were born here, who are Americans, and I speak with a lot, too, and are feeling even more isolated. So that creates even more of a problem, because you're pushing potentially young people into that direction. And the other part of this is, as you know, the history of mankind, this has always been, unfortunately, brutality. And we have created these dictators in Iraq, right? We support the royal family in Saudi Arabia, which has the extreme religion of Wahhabism, which has been around for quite some time, which feeds into ISIS. And so that unfortunately does bring in, as you said, you know, the geopolitics as well, that creates these situations and then creates the vacuums in which these extreme groups can manifest themselves. And the last comment I want to make is...
Very quickly, Martha. We're almost out of time.
Yep. Last comment is about headscarves. I go over there as in respect to another culture and modesty. I wear headscarf and loose clothes. And you just made I find it very liberating.
Mm-hmm.
It's wonderful not to have to be hung up as a woman about how you look.
Martha, we got to leave it there.
Yep.
And thanks so much for the phone call. And a very quick response, please.
Martha, those are all really good comments. I agree with you. It's liberating to cover yourself. So when Muslims say that, I tend to agree, although I wouldn't want it to be forced on me or on any other woman. And your other points were very good as well, that Muslims are very family-oriented, and we do need to understand this. And one of my favorite stories is Zal Khalilzad, who was ambassador in Iraq and later became ambassador to the UN. He came as a refugee from Afghanistan as a Muslim, only in this country. Could you come as a refugee Muslim and become U.S. ambassador to the UN? We live in a great country.
And again, your husband, Daniel Speckard, former ambassador to Greece. You are both kind of steeped in international affairs. And I want to touch on something before we have to say goodbye to you. You may have some news about one of your earlier books, Warrior Princess, A Navy SEAL's Journey to Coming Out Transgender.
Okay, well, I'm going to knock on wood while I say this, but I've got a movie offer on it. It's very exciting, and we're signing it this week. So it will be, hopefully, knock on wood, a feature film. Bride of ISIS has an inquiry for a TV film and Undercover Jihadi for a TV series. So the books are starting to have success in that way.
Are we going to see a sequel to Bride of ISIS? You've got these two characters, two FBI agents.
Maybe.
There's some chemistry between them.
Yeah, I hope so. We'll see. I like writing, so we'll see what happens.
And Anne, where are you heading to next? You've been in Managua for a few months for some rest and relaxation. What's next for you?
Well, I wasn't just resting. I was writing up there and going back up till the end of the week and then back to Washington. And we'll see. Probably then to Greece and Spain, I hope.
Anne Speckard, thanks so much for being with us once again.
You're welcome.
And we do want to thank today's guest, Dr. Anne Speckard. She is an adjunct associate professor of psychiatry and security studies at Georgetown University, the author of Bride of ISIS, One Young Woman's Path into Homegrown Terrorism. You can find out more about Anne and her other books at her website, annespeckard.com. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks to our executive producer, Rick Ryer, and our on-air producer, Jane Ritger. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. Remember to follow us on Facebook. If you missed part of the show, you can hear it in its entirety Friday evening at 7 on WHRM 90.9 FM Wausau. The program can also be downloaded at wpr.org/Route51. Route 51 is heard every Thursday at 10 a.m. on the Ideas Network stations WLBL 91.9 FM Wausau and 930 a.m. Auburndale Stevens Point, WHBM 90.3 FM Park Falls, WHAA 89.1 FM Adams, Wisconsin Rapids, WHSF 89.9 FM Rhinelander Eagle River, and WHRM 90.9 FM High Definition Channel 3. I'll be hosting the Joy Cardine Show tomorrow from 6 until 9 a.m. on the Ideas Network statewide. Hope to hear from you then. And thank you for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.